This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
Hi guys, this is Press Play on Tape, aka Steve, and you're listening to episode 77 of the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, The Retro Asylum. Coming up, we've got an absolutely fascinating interview with an industry legend, and without wanting to give too much away, let's just say this guy's created some of the most amazing C64 and Amiga music ever written. So if you're into your classic game music, I think you're really going to enjoy listening to what he's got to say. Before we get to that, there's just a few little things I'd like to mention. Firstly, as always, a huge shout out to the Retro Asylum sponsors. This month we'd like to thank Stelios, Anthony Ogden, Michael J. Hay, John Stretford and Dino Dini. Dino obviously created the amazing kickoff series and is the reason that I managed to beat Mr. Sid in our most recent podcast when we went head to head for the best Amiga sports game. So big thanks to Dino for that one. Now these guys really do help us keep the show running with their continued support, so massive thanks to them. Now, incidentally, if you'd like to become a Retro Asylum sponsor yourself, please just head over to our website, theretroasylum.com, and click on the PayPal button. You can donate as much or as little as you like, and all donations really are appreciated as they allow us to keep on creating these podcasts and to maintain the website. And while you're there, why not check out funstock.co.uk? These guys sell literally everything retro-related, from old-school games and consoles to new retro items like the handheld console, the Dingu, and the Neo Geo X. Uniforix actually chatted to the head of Funstock, Andy Pearson, in one of our recent podcasts, and it was fascinating to hear just how they came about. Andy was also kind enough to give us a discount code to use on their site. So if you go on their site and you want to purchase something, just use the discount code ASYLUM to get yourself a nice 10% off the price. So big thanks to Andy and Funstock for that. Now another thing I'd quickly like to mention is the Retro Asylum Tour. As you've probably heard in the show a couple of weeks back, Andy, Ali and the guys recorded a live podcast in front of a huge audience of retro gamers at Geek 2014. They talked about their retro gaming experiences, the games they were into, they gave out prizes, loads of audience interaction, and the whole thing sounded amazing. So if you haven't checked out that podcast, you should definitely have a listen to it. It's episode 74. Now, off the back of this, the Retro Asylum Tour will be continuing with the team appearing at nearly all the big retro gaming events around the UK this year. The next one is Play Expo in Blackpool on the 3rd and 4th of May, and I'll hopefully be joining the team myself for that one. Also coming up is the Retro Asylum's very own event, Retromania 2 in Croydon in May, NERG on the 5th and 6th of July, and also Revival on the 9th and 10th of August in Wolverhampton. So if you get a chance, please come along, join in, meet the team, and maybe even win some of the prizes. Now, another news this week, it appears that once again the Retro Asylum podcast has been climbing the iTunes charts, in thanks no doubt to you guys continuing to download the show and leaving us amazing reviews. I believe at last count we were at number 7 in the iTunes chart, and this month so far we've had 5 new 5-star reviews, so I'd like to say a massive thanks to JazzKing72, Aaron White, Madge82, Jabby1976 and ShiftTheUK for taking the time to leave us some awesome reviews. Now, one last thing I'd like to mention before we get to the main part of the show is a little update about the podcast I recorded recently with Mr. Sid. Now, in that episode, me and Mr. Sid went head-to-head to try and battle it out and come up with a definitive and completely biased best-of list of Commodore 64 and Amiga games. Now, the show seemed to go down pretty well with the community. I've had some lovely responses and huge thanks for that. But there was a bit of debate on the forums and on Twitter as to me winning the best Amiga platform around with my choice of Shadow of the Beast, which was up against Mr. Sid's choice of James Bond 2 Robocod. Now, to be fair to Sam, I think he was probably going easy on me as it was my first ever Retro Asylum podcast. But he's now come out and said that he's changed his mind and that he feels that James Bond should have won. So in the spirit of being fair and to stop all the tweets, I'd just like to say, yeah, I'm happy to concede that James Bond was the better game. Even though I've got a soft spot for Shadow of the Beast and I think it's possibly a better looking game, when it comes down to it, James Bond is more fun and it's a better platformer. So yeah, Mr. Sid, you win. Oh, and just in a quick reply to the other people on Twitter who mentioned this, I know I said Sam's name a lot during the podcast, but sadly, I'm not actually Derek Okora. Well, thanks for pointing out that I sound like him. But Sam, from now on, I'm going to be calling you Mr. Sid for the entire show. And to be fair, I had a great time working on that podcast with Mr. Sid, and I'd just like to say huge thanks to him for inviting me to do it. Now, funnily enough, we're going to be recording again soon. I'm going to be doing a podcast together all about Ocean Software. Now we're going to be talking about the history of the company, the people who work there, the best games, the worst games, the eventual demise of the company. But what we'd love is for you guys to get involved. So if you'd like to take part, we're looking for people to send us a short clip about their favourite game, which we'll include in the podcast. Just a short audio clip. Doesn't have to be long, couple of minutes, just to say, this is my favourite Ocean game and this is why. And if you're up for that, please record your clip on the computer, on your phone, and send it to sam@retroasylum.com. And we'll include your clip in the show, which we'll be bringing out on the 25th of April. Right, okay, so it's almost time to get on with the main part of the podcast. But before I do that, I just want to give a quick shout out and say a massive thanks to Andy for setting this up for me. It's an amazing experience when you get to actually speak to one of your childhood heroes. And it wouldn't have been possible without Andy working away in the background to set this up. So huge thanks, Andy, and I hope you like it. Okay, so without further ado, let's start the show.
Welcome to the Retro Asylum.
Hi guys, this is Press Play on Tape, aka Steve, and today I'm talking to one of the most revered and well-regarded C64 and Amiga musicians of all time. He's written the music for an incredible catalogue of games, including titles such as Apidia, R-Type, Jim Power, The Great Guiana Sisters, and of course the legendary Turrican series. I'm of course talking to the one and only Chris Hulsbeck. Chris, thanks so much for talking to us today. How are you?
Very good, hi.
Are you having a good day?
Yes, absolutely.
What time is it where you are, Chris?
It's 1:30 in the afternoon and sunny California. It is sunny today.
I'm quite jealous, Chris. It's 9:30 in the evening here in cold Liverpool.
Oh my.
It's raining, it's dark, so I'm quite jealous.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris, well, here at the Retro Asylum, we love talking about all things retro. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to chat to you a little bit about your career, your music, and some of the incredible tracks that you've written. I'm sure many of our listeners will fondly remember. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely. Thanks for your interest.
Oh, no problem at all. We're big fans. Right then, Chris, let's go right back to the start. Can you tell me a little bit about your musical background before you started writing music for games?
Yes, you know, I grew up in a family that was very musical. My grandma, my aunt, my mom, they were all piano teachers. So we had instruments in the house and I was already like hammering away on the piano at age 4. And so they also tried to teach me the classical way, but I didn't like it, especially since my grandma was a little bit of an old school piano teacher and she would essentially hit you if you made a mistake. I don't know. But it was also because I already started to develop my own melodies and ideas at a very young age. And I wasn't that interested in playing the, you know, classical music from a piece of paper somebody else had done. In fact, the only thing I did in terms of like playing other people's music was pop music that I heard on the radio. I was drawn to and I figured out by listening to what the notes are and then played those melodies on the piano.
So what were your influences at the time musically?
Yeah, I don't remember a lot of the names, but that was obviously in the 70s, end of 70s, and I don't know. I mean, it was very wild. I remember, though, there was this first electronic music piece that really influenced me, which was called Popcorn.
Okay.
I think the group was called Hot Butter. Or something like that. So it was this.
I know the one. I've heard that one.
Yeah, exactly that one. And that had like sounds that I hadn't heard like that before, you know. And I was very fascinated by that. And I learned that those sounds were made by a synthesizer. So I was very drawn to the idea of that was something technical that interested me, and then also my musical interests. And so I was from my early teenager years, I was dreaming of owning my own synthesizer. but my family could never afford to buy such expensive machinery. I mean, they were really pricey at the time. And that's also basically how I got into the Commodore 64, because I read in an advertisement that that had like a real synthesizer sound chip. And that was kind of within reach. And yeah, from then on, I was working towards that goal.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you next, Chris. So can you tell us a little bit how you started getting into writing music for games? Was it just at first just sort of creating your own sounds on the Commodore and then moving on from there?
Yeah, really. Yeah, it was definitely that Commodore 64 had that synthesizer sound chip that was very important. But I also had discovered like arcade machines, and I was gaming away my pocket money and whatever. And then I got an Atari, the VCS system, that kind of waned me off the arcade machines. But I was also very much addicted to video games. So when I finally got the Commodore 64 with the goal of making music with it, really for the first year I was only playing games.
I can't be helped, Chris. You've got to play games on a Commodore 64.
Exactly. So, but the thing is, I mean, I was a little bit addicted to gaming, but I also was very fascinated by the idea of how is a game even done. So in the first place, when I started programming, I really wanted to be a games programmer.
Okay.
Or designer. And I started, like many people, with the basic programming language. And it was for gaming, it was just way too slow. So pretty quick after, I started to pick up assembly language, which is, you know, writing the CPU codes. And that's really like the fastest way to, not fast in terms of how to get to a result, but when you execute an assembly program, it's incredibly fast. So you can really like do crazy things, scroll a whole screen or something like that, and move a lot of objects on the screen.
Okay, so how did you move from there then into actually programming the SID chip?
Yeah, so the thing was, I wasn't really very good in game programming or game designing, but a friend of mine, he had already made one or two commercial games and sold them, but he wasn't good with music. So we kind of combined forces, and I had already started a little bit to create my own sound drivers, first for my own games. But then, you know, he had a new game in the works that he wanted to sell, and he asked me if I could do some music stuff for him, and I did. And that game was called Planet of War,
okay,
which was essentially then shelved for a little bit. It didn't come out until like a year or a year and a half later. So in the timeline of things, that the release of the game is kind of after I got my break, essentially, in the industry. But it was really my first music for a game. And I got kind of like sucked into this music thing, and I was really like excited about improving my sound driver and stuff like that. So I tooled away, and then I read about a contest in a magazine in Germany, the 64 magazine, which was one of the biggest selling magazines in Germany for computers.
So how old are you at this point, Chris? How old are you at this stage?
There I'm, I think, 16 or 17.
Oh, so quite young.
Yeah. No, I started really early. And so I read about this contest, and they wanted music programmed on the Commodore 64. So people could send in their program on a disc, and they would be, you know, judged by a jury. And my idea was to get at least into the charts of like the first 10, because they would appear on the cover disc of that magazine.
Okay.
That was my goal. So I worked feverishly, and the thing is, and this has been like a thing throughout my career, I always seem to do things last minute. So I was tooling away on the sound driver for about, 6 weeks. But really, the track that I sent in, I made the last night before the deadline of sending material in. And it was really like, I started at 9 in the evening, and I was done at 4 in the morning. And I had school the next day. So it was quite crazy. And then I woke up with rings under my eyes, you know, and I went and gave this to my parents, the disc, and said, you have to bring this to the post office, because I couldn't go. And I was just lucky that they listened, and they actually did it. And to my surprise, I made first place on that contest.
How long did you have to wait until you find out?
It was about a week and a half or so. I got a call. My parents said, oh, there's somebody on the phone. And I didn't know what it was about. And when I heard the editor there saying I won it, I was really like jumping a couple feet in the air. And I couldn't believe it. Yeah.
How did it lead on, having success in that competition? How did that propel you into the next step in your career?
Right. So I was with those guys from the magazine. I was actually on the phone quite a bit after that, because especially the editor there had really an interest. He said, I can't believe how you could even do music like that. He wanted to know more how it's done. So I explained it to him. And that's when I got the idea of, this is kind of complicated, because the music data I did in a machine language monitor, or what you would call it, it's like a program where you can peek into the memory of the machine, and it's all like hex numbers, and it's very, very technical, complicated, and only I knew where to place the right values and stuff like that to make the sound. And then I thought, well, this process could be much improved by making like a dedicated editor that kind of like puts these values into a context. And so I worked on that, and he said, well, if you can do a program like that, that could be our listing of the months or whatever, which was another big thing, also money-wise, that was interesting. And I wanted to do it for myself anyway, so I tooled on that over the, I think it was 1987 or 1986. Over the summer, and I finished it, and that was called the Sound Monitor. And this is essentially like from the editing, a little bit comparable to the later sound trackers on the Amiga. Okay. So it's maybe like the grandfather of all sound trackers, if you will. And so you could like type in notes by note names, actually. So you had like C, D, E, F, G as like note names, and then an octave, and you had a sharp symbol for the black keys and stuff like that. So that was already like a much improvement over like putting in the plain hex numbers in another program.
So you're taking away the machine code for musicians who couldn't program, essentially.
Exactly. So really, people who understood a little bit about music and computers, they could make music without going too much into the technical details. And that made listing of the months. And actually, from that money, I bought an Amiga already. That was the end of 86. I think I was the second person in my area that had an Amiga computer. But I was already like thinking into the future, you know, what's next? But then I made like a very bold move, and I just did like cold calling the biggest games company over in Germany, which was called Rainbow Arts. And I just called them up on the phone. And I said, hey, I won this contest, and I did this other thing. Don't you need like music for your games? And I don't know, I was on the phone with the boss of that company for like 2 hours, playing him tunes over the phone and stuff like that. And he basically hired me on the spot.
Wow.
Yeah, he even, you know, I was in middle of the 12th grade, but I took the opportunity, and I just, I left the school at the middle of the school year, and I went to work for them.
The risk obviously paid off.
I would say so. I wouldn't recommend that to somebody today. Get an education. It's really important.
Fair enough. So what was the first commercial game that you worked on then, Chris?
I'm not exactly sure. They had a bunch of games in the works. I think the very first one, I'm not sure, might have been a game called Soldier on the Commodore 64.
Okay.
Which was kind of like comparable with the Rambo game. Somewhere between Rambo and Green Beret, I think. Something like that. I don't know. I don't remember it much, actually. But the guy who did that, Hans Ippisch, he's actually a bigwig now in the Computec company.
Well, I was going to ask you, Chris, so what was the process then for creating the music for the Commodore 64 games? Did the developer come to you with the design of the game and screenshots, or did you get to play it first, or did they just tell you, make a piece of music and send it in? Or
It was all like a mix back then, and I think companies started to figure it out. I definitely was able to see the games from an early stage, especially since I then joined their offices pretty soon after. And I was really like there while they were developing the game. So I was there from the early concept phase, and even helping them with some programming stuff. I remember I had a pretty good scrolling system that I used for my own game prototypes that they adapted.
You mentioned before using the tracker software on the Amiga. So how did your work in practice change when you switched from the Commodore 64 over to the Amiga?
Yeah, and I always used my own tool. So I never got into the actual sound tracker. That was another person's program. But I had my own, which was called TFMX. A little bit silly. I thought at the time, you know, this would be the final music system I would ever make. And that's where the name TFM came from. And then I extended it a little bit. So I put an X at the end. That's how I came up with the end.
Name. I like your ambition, yeah. Though, Chris.
I know. Little did I know. I was like, I was naive. but that system, actually, the principle behind it was that. And I actually did that on the Commodore 64 too. This was basically the successor of the sound monitor, which had a special feature which I called the macro sound programming language. And it had essentially like the sound monitor had a fixed set of like values that would influence the sounds, but they would be like a one-time thing, and then you had some other options to influence the sound after. But what I did with the TFM or TFMX system was that I actually implemented something where you the moment a note is triggered, a little script runs with my own kind of programming language. So with that, I was able to do anything to the sound chip for each frame it was running. So you could like really change a lot of parameters, and it was not fixed. You could change it from music to music. You could be creative with the sound design as well as the musical melodies and stuff like that. And that system actually, I ported to the Amiga, and the concept was later used on the Super Nintendo and Mega Drive, and then even on the Nintendo 64 and GameCube, where we developed it further. I worked with Factor 5 at the time, and that became the Musix sound system, which was actually licensed by Nintendo as their official developer tool.
Wow, so it nearly lived up to its name of the final music system.
Kind of, at least the concept of it. I wasn't programming it later, but yeah.
So what type of studio did you have at the time you were creating the 16-bit music?
Yeah, one thing that they also got me to sign up for working for Rainbow Arts was that the boss said, oh, he would buy me a synthesizer. Which
you've been wanting.
Which was, I mean, I, how could I say no to that, you know? That was a Ensoniq ESQ-1 that I picked, which I have the successor, which is compatible still to this day. It's actually sitting here next to me.
Wow.
The Ensoniq SQ-80. And so that was my keyboard that I had. And then I had... you know, I'd started to assemble a little studio, and it grew over the years until actually like in the mid 90s, I had like a full fledged studio. I think I invested like 50,000 or so into it, was all like big mixing board and several MIDI modules and samplers and keyboards and stuff like that. And, all in this dedicated room. Yeah, that was crazy.
I think that's the problem with the studio technology, Chris. I'm a musician myself, and you just keep buying more and more and more, and you don't use most of
it. Interestingly, then it became kind of full circle, because in the 2000s and on, the virtual studio revolution happened, where you could simulate all this machinery in a computer again. And nowadays I'm working on a laptop that's just a powerful laptop, and it simulates all the stuff that I could ever dream of.
It seems almost silly now having all that hardware when you can do it in software.
Absolutely. I got some of that hardware left, but it's sitting around here, and I'm not even like sure if I could, if I sell it off eBay, I'm not getting much for it.
Okay, so let's just wind back there to talking about when you were creating music for the Amiga games. What was your process there? Would you write the music using proper instrumentation at first? Would you write score and your keyboard parts and drum parts and everything, and then port it into the Amiga? Or did you do it immediately in your software?
Often I would develop the melodies on the synthesizer keyboards. And I always, at the time, and I still do, I record everything I do. So I had, back then, I actually had a tape recorder running constantly when I was jamming on the keyboard, so that I wouldn't forget anything that I played. Or I could go back, like a couple months later and listen and pick out the best parts and stuff like that. So most of the time I would develop the basic ideas before I would try to implement them. But then at other times I would also start with maybe like a rhythm and program that in and have me inspired by that. Okay. But I would say most of the times the ideas started with a keyboard sound.
So this is a bit of a generic question for you, Chris, but what piece of music from that era are you most proud of?
Well, I mean, there's like for every era, there had been like a piece that was kind of pivotal or set the stage for the following stuff that was coming. So when I started with the Commodore 64, obviously the piece that won the contest, the Shades, that I'm still proud of and amazed how that turned out. And then on the Amiga computer, I think it was the R-Type title, which introduced kind of like orchestral sounding samples, which was something new because the Amiga had the sample sound chip, which could do much different sounds than the Commodore 64 synthesizer sound chip could do. And then obviously like the Turrican series, I have a lot of things. I'm really happy how they turned out.
I think a lot of people love both those soundtracks, Chris. R-Type in particular is one of my favorites. I love the Turrican music. The Turrican music is superb, but the theme tune from R-Type is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, I remember that really, that piece when I finished that. And the thing was I don't know if you realize, but the Commodore 64 version of R-Type sounds very different. And the reason was that I felt when I could have just ported the Commodore 64 piece to the Amiga and that would have probably worked. But I figured, the Amiga has this unique sound of its own, so why not try something totally new? And I tooled around for a night, and when I finished the piece, I played it for the guys at the company, and they essentially filled up my room, and they wanted to hear it over and over because they couldn't believe it. So that was really a big success within the company.
Well, to be honest, Chris, when I used to have that game, I used to boot it up, and because it played while it was loading, didn't it? It was just before the title screen, it would play your R-Type theme.
I think so, yeah.
I would just reboot the computer and listen to it again and then reboot. I didn't play the game half the time.
Yeah.
I'm sure I put it on a tape and had it in my car as well. It was an incredible piece of music. So what was your inspiration behind that music? Was there, you said there about trying to get orchestral instrumentation into it?
That was the basic thing. And then I wanted a melody that kind of like is something that could, in theory, have its place in a movie or as like the theme of a TV show or something like that. It was just supposed to be very catchy and use these instruments. And that was, by the way, I sampled a Korg M1, which I had acquired just before that. So that was also part of the inspiration. The Korg M1 was the first big sample-based workstation, or ROM player in that case, because it couldn't sample itself, but it had like a ROM with live instruments that were recorded there. And that was very inspiring.
But the irony being, Chris, that the music for the Amiga version that you wrote was actually better than the music in the arcade game. So the Amiga version was almost better than the arcade game due just to the fact it had your music at the beginning.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, cool.
If it's okay with you, Chris, then I'd like to just play your R-Type theme now just for our listeners. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
This is Anthony, aka Uniforex, and you're listening to Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast.
Now, you later revisited this piece and recorded it with a full orchestra, which sounded incredible. Now, is this how you kind of envisioned the track originally, but you were restricted by, you know, obviously the Amiga hardware?
I would definitely say so. And I mean, I have to give credit to the arranger and orchestrator. So this whole concert was put on by Thomas Burko, who is a big fan of mine. He actually used to write me as a teenager that he's my biggest fan, and I had gotten a lot of those letters before. And but in the end, now I could probably say he's definitely my biggest fan, because the way he put his you know, interest in game music and my music particular into action, that really made these concerts happening. That's just incredible.
Well, I was going to ask you, Chris, how do you go about approaching these kind of projects? Because obviously the original Amiga music was just four channels of audio. So how do you take that into a full-blown orchestra piece? Do you just send him the music, or did you work hand-in-hand with him? And how did you develop it?
Yeah, actually, in this case, it was kind of out of my hands. I mean, Thomas had done a bunch of concerts with game music over the years, and he had like this incredible team, and the main orchestrator there was Jonne Valton, which is, I think, in scene music parts he was known as Purple Motion, I think. And so he studied orchestral music and arranging for orchestras, and he took my composition and reworked it for the orchestra. And of course, I mean, they sent me like early versions, and you know, we were discussing things. But I have to really thank them for taking it to that level, which is absolutely incredible. I was sitting in the concert, and I had tears running down my face. It's just such a incredible, mind-blowing feeling when you're sitting there and hearing your own music performed by like 60, 70, you know, skilled musicians on a stage. That's just, would have never believed that would happen.
I mean, I've listened to the orchestral versions of your tracks, Chris, and I mean, obviously I've only heard them on CD, but they are absolutely fantastic. So I would imagine being sat in front of that full orchestra live and it being your own music must have just been absolutely like a high point for you. I mean, you've had an illustrious career, but that must have been a high point.
Absolutely. Can definitely agree on that. That was crazy. Just crazy. I wish my grandma would have like lived to see that, because she always said like, oh, you got so much talent, but you're wasting it with these games and stuff like that. And, you know, if she could have seen what became of it, I think she would have been very proud and happy.
I think not only is it wonderful that it was, you know, transformed into an orchestral piece, but it's a testament to your original music that it could be transformed. You know, it shows just how good the music was in the first place, that you could put an orchestra behind it and it would sound that good. I mean, that is a testament to what you wrote in the first place.
Yeah, thanks.
Your most recent project was the Turrican Soundtrack Anthology, which was done through the Kickstarter platform. Now, why did you decide to focus on Turrican for this album?
Yeah, so that project was actually something that was on my mind for a bunch of years now, because So I did this album in 93, which was a compilation of a few tracks, or some of the most popular tracks of the Turrican series. But it was, you know, omitting a lot of other cool pieces as well. So over the years, obviously, I got a lot of requests by fans, you know, when are you going to do another Turrican album and stuff like that. But I didn't know how to make something like that, because I knew that it would take a lot of time. And obviously, I mean, I'm not a teenager anymore, living with my family supporting me. So I have to live while I'm working on something and earn money. And so I didn't know exactly how that could be done. Especially, like, I thought if I do another Turrican project, it should be fairly complete. So first I was thinking about just extending the old album and doing other pieces that were missing. But then this idea came about to make it maybe bigger. And the the point where I realized it could be done was when a friend of mine did a Kickstarter for his own album, and he got his funds. Was a much smaller project, but I had never heard anything about crowdfunding before, and I thought, wow, this may be a way to get this project realized, asking the fans to basically pitch in advance and give me the funds necessary to produce that. And then this was also like churning, and I had I put this plan together, but it wasn't quite ready. And then the adventure game, Double Fine Adventure. I already was in the planning stage of putting my own campaign together, and then that hit. And when we saw their numbers, that's really when we and me and my team, we kicked into gear and figured that we could maybe try to create something really big and amazing here. And so this was also, by the way, again, one of my team members was Thomas Berker, who put the orchestras together, and then really exploded from there, from just going from like maybe one or two follow-up CDs to a total of three or four CDs, including some orchestra version and stuff like that. And so, yeah, we put that campaign together, and it we're very nervous when we put it live, and to our surprise, it was really rewarded, and we got our funds together after just a week. 250% of the original planned budget. Amazing. So it's really crazy, yeah.
I think, to be honest, Chris, I mean, going through the Kickstarter process, it can be risky, but it does allow people who are fans of your music to really sort of get involved, you know, because they feel like they've actually got hands-on now. Instead of just buying an album that's been released and getting it through iTunes or something, they feel like they're part of the process instead, you know. And I think that's, it's great for sort of fans of yourself to just be able to get involved and do that.
Yeah, I was really happy that I still had so many loyal fans that were supporting this effort.
I think you're always going to have loyal fans, Chris.
Thanks. But by the way, did you participate as well?
I only heard about it afterwards, to be honest. I have heard the albums, and what I will do is I'll put a link, because I know you can see them on your website now, Chris.
Right, we have actually a dedicated website, thetarikansoundtrack.com, and that gives you all the options. It's now out on iTunes, Amazon, and especially Bandcamp is, I think, a fan favorite, because they can get the you know, like lossless FLAC compression, the exact CD quality.
I'll be purchasing it after this interview, don't worry, Chris.
Yeah.
But I will put a link on our website as well, and with the podcast as well, just for the fans to go and have a look at that. And hopefully our listeners will be downloading that.
Awesome.
So have you got any plans to create any other albums of tracks from your back catalogue?
Yeah, there's actually a bunch that I have been working on or planning on for a while. I think one I realized kind of was the, do you remember the Genesis, the Twisted Dreams that
yes.
came out a year and a half ago? We put an album together for that. But that could be interesting to maybe make a Genesis anthology as well at some point, which would be a slightly smaller project, but could be still interesting. Then I have another one of my favorites is the Jim Power soundtrack, which came out on the Amiga originally and then was ported actually onto three or four other platforms.
I'll be honest, I played Jim Power about a week ago on an emulator.
That
music is awesome.
Yeah, and actually I did a studio version of that already in the early 90s, just about the time when I did the To Be On Top and the Turrican album. We did essentially like another port of that game, or they did a port for the PC engine. And they had like a CD-ROM version of that console. And that was essentially my first Redbook soundtrack, if you will. And so we produced that music in the studio, and they put it on the CD to play back during the game. And so that would be interesting to revisit and put out.
It's an absolutely great soundtrack, Chris. So I think definitely if you're going to do it, go back to that one.
Yeah.
So, bit more of a generic question for you now, Chris. What advice would you give to somebody who is wanting to get into creating music for games nowadays?
Yeah, First off, it's definitely not as easy as it was when, or I don't know if you could say it was actually easy back then, but there was much less competition. And it was easier to make your mark back then. But if you're really interested, it can be very rewarding, but it's probably a long process where you have to work another day job or something, or work on this for a long time to get into the industry. And I think next to talent, the most important thing is like tenacity and believe in yourself and not give up.
Like phoning up the company and speaking to the head like you did.
Right. And that, by the way, is something that doesn't quite work anymore these days. In fact, one thing I always advise against is sending in your music demos or something that's usually tossed by the companies. They don't really pay attention to that. It's all about like personal contacts that you make, which is kind of similar to what I did. But you have to start befriending the people who make the games, essentially, and that can be difficult at times. But it's like industry events where you meet the people who make the games, like the game developers conferences and stuff like that. I would definitely visit those. There's online forums and portals where you can network. One of the best known ones is the Game Audio Network Guild in the US. I think they might have also chapters in other countries. But there's the VGM list, the Video Game Musicians list. That's actually from guys from the UK. One of my buddies there, Andrew Barnabas, and yeah, the internet makes it possible to put your music out and get feedback from fans and stuff like that. That helps. Also, if you can then, if you make some friends, a video game developer, and they're really willing to listen to what you're doing, it's easy to point them to your SoundCloud or something. And if you have like a sizable audience and good feedback from your own fans, that will already help you and stuff like that. So, and then obviously, I mean, having a musical education, if you can nowadays, orchestrate and arrange for orchestra yourself, that would obviously be a plus.
Yeah.
So I think now more than ever, a good music education is really valuable.
So essentially work hard at it and be tenacious.
You have to work hard, yes. That's the thing. But it can be very rewarding. So if you got the talent, then definitely look into it and go for it, if that's your dream.
Brilliant. That's great advice, Chris. So can I just ask what you're currently working on at the moment?
Usually I can't talk about the projects I'm working on because of the NDAs that I sign. But the last thing I did was actually Doctor Who Legacy on the iOS and Android platform, which is a puzzle game with the Doctor Who license, which I thought was awesome because I love science fiction, love Doctor Who, of course, and that that theme was always one of my favorites, which it's I think one of the very first, if not the first, commercial electronic music that was ever produced, I think.
It's a very famous track, and it's still going today, isn't it? They haven't really changed it much even now.
Absolutely. That is that will always be reinvented, but the melody is still there. And that was a very cool project to work on.
So was it a remix of the actual Doctor Who theme tune you were working on, or was it just parts for the game? Or
yeah, this was interesting. I actually, so the game developer did have the rights to make the game and everything, but they didn't have the rights to the music. So the idea was to make actually a remix of the theme music, additionally to in-game music that was supposed to be original. But I like to believe that I did it too good with my remix, because the BBC got inspired by the whole game and how it sounded and how it looked like. So they in the end swapped out my remix that I did for the original theme music from the latest TV show.
Yeah,
whatever. I mean, it's a little bit sad, but the in-game music I composed, it turned out quite well.
We'll have to get the listeners to check that one out, Chris. We'll have a look.
It's actually free to play, so everybody can download it.
Brilliant. What's the full name of it?
Doctor Who Legacy.
Doctor Who Legacy, okay, we'll check that out. So what are your plans for the future, Chris? I know you do movie music now as well as game music and stuff. What's next?
I would definitely like to get into movies. I did a couple of like short films and no budget movies and stuff like that in the past, but I would really like to get into maybe writing music for a feature or a documentary or a TV show. And I've been working towards that goal for a while. I actually got an agent now in Hollywood. So I'm part of the Max Steiner agency, and I did a bunch of trailer work now that hopefully will get picked up someday. And I still do a lot of game music, obviously.
I, for one, hope the movie stuff comes off, Chris, because I'd like to watch TV or film with a soundtrack by Chris Yorsbeck. That would be awesome.
that's been a dream of mine, actually, for since the early 90s, I think, to do something like that. And I'm pretty confident that could still happen. So I keep working towards that goal.
Final question for you, Chris, because the listeners would kill me if I didn't ask this. What's your favorite classic system and why?
Oh, that's such a hard question, because you're probably going to piss off somebody.
That's okay.
But for me, it's got to be the Amiga.
Yes.
I mean, the thing is, I love the Commodore 64 and the SID sound chip, but with the Amiga, you could just do, you had a little bit more freedom, not just because it had four voices from the get-go, but also because of that sampling capability. It was just easier to express yourself and get the sounds that you wanted into the system. So yeah, it's got to be the Amiga.
I'm so pleased you've chose the Amiga, because I was on a previous podcast just basically saying that the Amiga is my all-time favorite computer. So to have you back me up just means that I win. Thanks to you.
I have to say also, like, the Amiga computer was so much ahead of its time. I mean, if you compared like what the Amiga did in terms of operating system, and that was like even before Windows came out. If Commodore had played their cards right, this could have been, you know, the system today, and then they just blew it.
Well, I think they were the first with a true multitasking operating system, weren't they?
Exactly. Yeah, it was true multitasking. I mean, you had like even these planes of different graphic modes that could move behind each other. I've never seen anything like that since. And it's sad that they went under. I think, I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons why that happened. But I mean, at the time when they went under, I really mourned the end of that era.
Me too, Chris, to be honest. You know, I think if they'd had or made better managerial decisions towards the end, they could still be going now. They could be like an Apple or a Microsoft.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. Absolutely.
And they was, you know, the Amiga was so far ahead of its time, like you just said. It was such a powerful computer. But they seemed to lose track of where they were going towards the end when they switched from the Amiga 500 to the 600 to the 1200 and sort of the CD32 as well.
Yeah, they were concentrating too much on their gamer home market, I think.
I think they were trying to break into the console market. I think
that was right, exactly. And then I think kind of like, for me, one of the final nails in the coffin was that CDTV, which was just a device that boggled my mind, how you could like sell, even try to sell a consumer device that had a caddy for a CD.
Well, it was like almost a first, like a DVD player almost. It was like a multimedia center.
It was, but it used these caddies where you had to put the CD into a caddy first. And I'm thinking like the poor chap in like a computer or hi-fi store or whatever, explaining to the customer that he can't like push a button and the tray comes out and puts the CD in, but he has to like put them into this caddy and plug that in, and then, you know,
It was a strange design, Chris. It really was. It was almost a good idea, but you know, the consumer wasn't ready for that kind of thing. And I don't think they had a direction with it either. What was it? Was it a multimedia center? Was it for looking at encyclopedias? Was it for playing games? What? And the controller as well. What was it? Oh, well. But at least you picked the Amiga, Chris. That's the one for me. Great, Chris. Okay, well, I think it's best we start to wrap things up now. So,
okay. Thanks again for your interest. You definitely brightened my day with your questions.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it, Chris. It's been an absolute privilege to talk to you. You know, I'd like to say thanks for taking the time to speak to us. You've created some of the best game music from my childhood, and I'd imagine a lot of our listeners feel the same way. So, and it's been fascinating to hear your story firsthand. And I think any of our listeners who are, you know, thinking about becoming game musicians and stuff, they'll be inspired by what you've said as well.
All right. Well, thanks again. And also, like, a special thanks to my UK listeners and fans. That's, I hope I will be able to someday come to an event over there again.
Oh, please let us know if you do, Chris, because you'd be more than welcome. Okay, well, like I say, I just want to say thanks again, Chris, and wish you all the best of luck for your future projects. I'm particularly looking forward to that TV show or movie with your soundtrack.
Thanks.
If it's okay with you, I'd like to play out with your orchestral version of the R-Type theme tune.
Oh, yes, thank you. Cool.
I just think this is a phenomenal piece of music. So thanks again, Chris, and thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, I will have a layover, and I'm speaking in Germany at a media college in June, and on the way back I have a layover in London of about 5 hours. So the thing is, I actually love socks from Marks and Spencer, and I haven't been able to find them on their online store, and I've done this before. I did this layover in the past, so I will just take like the express train from the airport into the city to a Marks and Spencer and buy socks and then head back to the airport. So that's my little shopping trip.
That's good use of your time in England, Chris. Buying some socks from Marks and Spencer. I love it. I'm definitely going to edit that into the podcast. You do realise this?
Yes.
What an anecdote. Oh, that's brilliant. I'll try and get some of our listeners to send you some socks.
Oh, that would be great. But they're very specific. So they're like 100% cotton and they have a certain shape and form that I like.
Any particular colour? Do you like them stripy or?
Black.
Black.
Black. And they're kind of like, what do you call it? They have these stripes. Yeah.
So you want black, stripy, 100% cotton.
Yeah, it's not like a color socks. Stripe. It's like the way they're stitched.
That's the best part of the podcast so far, Chris. Right then, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, Chris. I wish you best of luck in the future for everything you're doing. I love all your tracks. I like that you like socks from Marks and Spencer. That's brilliant.
All right. So, yeah, have a nice evening. And until soon. Okay.
Thanks
until
again.
Then. Bye.
Cheers, Chris. Bye now.